Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now, as we sadly bid farewell to summer and enter into the new season, we thought it was time to take stock of some of the things we're looking forward to seeing, reading and listening to this autumn. Just by coincidence, I happen to be joined in the studio by three experts on the matter. Tim Robey, film critic for The Telegraph, John Mitchinson, co-founder of the publishers Unbound, and DJ and broadcaster Georgie Rogers. Welcome, everybody, to the programme.
Hello.
Hi.
All a bit shy. Never mind. We're gonna perk up. It's always a shame to do these things in such short order. Tim, we're gonna come to you first, and we're gonna come to your first movie, Call Me by Your Name. Shall we hear a bit of a clip of it?
Sounds
to
good.
Wet our listeners' appetites.
Shouldn't have said anything. Just pretend you never did.
Nature has cunning ways of finding our weakest spot.
A lot of moody whispering there on behalf of Luca Guadagnino, one of my favourite directors.
Great.
How well does this one fare in what is an amazing career for this man?
It's going to be his biggest film to date, I think. I mean, it's been a great year for gay love stories in cinema. We had Moonlight winning Best Picture. We've just had the British one, God's Own Country, which is excellent and out at the moment. This is the third one, if you like, in the hat trick. And it's tremendous. It's based on a very well-loved book by Andre Aciman about a kind of a love affair between this very young American kid who's like 17 and a late 20-something academic played by Armie Hammer. But the real find of the film is the young actor, who's a guy called Timothée Chalamet, who I think is really going places. And it's a very kind of languorous story. It's set in Italy one summer. They can't really, nothing can really happen between them because the parents are kind of watching out for what's happening. It's set in the 80s, and things are very tentative and very kind of hesitant, but then they gradually kind of flower in very kind of subtle and unexpected ways. And it's really wonderful.
It looks beautiful, and it looks so beautifully shot. I know the director, Luca Guadagnino.
That's
one of those. Everyone knows what it looks like. That word. No one knows. Is so good at these sort of languorous love stories. I loved what was it?
So the last one was a bigger splash.
Yeah, bigger splash,
which was the one with Tilda Swinton and Ralph Fiennes,
which was a bit nuts and very charming.
Yeah, nuts and charming. And then the one before was I Am Love, which was Tilda Swinton marrying into an aristocratic Italian clan. And this one is in a way more intimate than either of those. Very much focus in this one kind of house where the summer is unfolding, and these two characters kind of befriend each other and kind of get the measure of each other, and you get the sense of being this kind of moment between them that can't really be replicated. It's lovely, and it's very beautifully scored. That we heard on that clip, Sufjan Stevens it plays throughout it. So many of his songs are on the soundtrack. I think Armie Hammer really kind of comes into his own in it. But as I say, this kid, Timothée Chalamet, he could even get an Oscar nomination for it. He's sensationally good, and he's this real kind of live wire. You kind of can't take your eyes off him. Just watching how the love affair kind of transforms his outlook on life in this one sort of brief period is quite spellbinding.
It's an interesting one for the director himself. I interviewed him at the time of his last movie, and he sort of said, I don't want to make a film, and I know he's a gay guy, and he said he didn't want to make a film about his own experience, but it sounds like he's kind of getting close to that, or at least it's an interesting thing you say, that this is set in the 80s when it almost can be a love that dare not speak its name.
That's right, yeah, they're being very careful about it, the two characters. But the other thing I love about it is that the script is actually written by James Ivory of Merchant Ivory fame. He's 89, and he's written this fantastic screenplay. He was almost going to direct it himself, but they decided, in fact, it would be better if Luca took it on. And I think Luca's kind of sense of sensual experience really works for the film. His kind of long tracking shots and just the kind of capturing the whole environment is beautiful. But the words are great as well, and you get the real sense of James Ivory kind of buying into this kind of cultured world and the kind of interest in art and sculpture and all these things that the characters are talking about.
It's Call Me By Your Name. It is out in the UK, at least, on October the 27th. Much recommended by Tim Robey. Okay, Tim, so The Death of Stalin is your next choice. I'm really looking forward to this one personally. It's the new thing from Armando Iannucci. Should we take a quick peek?
Sure.
Stalin's dead.
He's dead.
Stalin is dead!
Oh, my God.
Our general secretary is lying in a puddle of indignity.
Yeah, he's feeling unwell, clearly.
I want to make a speech at my father's funeral.
No problem.
Technically, yes, but practically.
When I said no problem, what I meant was no problem.
Anyone familiar with Amano Iannucci's work can possibly see just the kind of cadence of the way people are speaking in the trailer there. It's got his name written all over it. Talk us through this one, what we might expect from this.
So, yeah, I mean, no one's seen it yet. It has me at Amano Iannucci. He hasn't made a film since In the Loop, which is quite a while ago now, which I really thought was fantastic. And the idea here, which I think is so clever, is that he's just allowed all the actors to speak in their own accents. So yeah. No one is doing a kind of a Russian accent, a kind of comedy Russian accent. Everyone's just speaking exactly as they want to. So you've got this great multinational cast. You've Steve Buscemi, you heard Jeffrey Tambor in there, Jason Isaacs is in it.
Apparently, Jason Isaacs is brilliant just in the trailer.
That's
as
right.
As a kind of brusque northern general.
He's hilarious.
General,
he seems to be doing Sean Bean as a Russian general, which is just my favourite idea ever. Apparently it really is the Simon Russell Beale show as well. This is like the first time in a film that Simon Russell Beale is really going to dominate and have almost the main role, because he's the kind of main advisor trying to pave the way for the succession after Stalin's death, essentially, and kind of being the kind of Machiavellian operator behind the scenes. It just looks fantastic. I mean, it's just a trailer that just had me immediately desperate to see it. And it's just going to have all those elements that you want from Iannucci's comedy, I think. But just transferring it from, you know, the Houses of Parliament to
yeah, that's
to
how it
Russia
seems. Like.
Much, gonna work. Yeah.
Much focus on the silliness of the minutiae of how to handle a diplomatic situation. Right. It's got In the Loop written all over it, or
exactly.
In the thick of it. There's some quite decent swearing in it, I expect, as well. All the classic Iannucci elements.
Yeah, and I imagine it's one that you'll want to watch more than once as well. Like any good episode of The Thick of It, you have to go back and watch them again, really.
The cast is one of those unusual ones. I wonder at what point this was kind of workshopped, you almost think, in order for everyone to be talking in their own accents and almost hamming up their own accents as well, right?
It's
quite a rare thing.
Exactly. I'd love to ask him that. Did he just decide from the start, right, we're just going to have them do exactly what they want? Because it will add to the comedy and it will kind of add to the weirdness of it.
Yeah.
And I think, the kind of comedy Russian accent routine, I just don't think that could possibly be quite as novel or fresh.
So. It's difficult to follow Peter Sellers, really. It's got strange. Yeah. Isn't it, right?
Yeah.
That was the last time it was funny, possibly. Who knows? Well, it's great stuff. The Death of Stalin, I think we're all around the table looking forward to that one. Fresh from the Iannucci stable. It's out on October the 20th in the UK. In short order, Tim, and we come to your final choice, it's Blade Runner 2049. Some of us might know what the original sounds like, possibly, but let's have a hit of the new one.
You're a cop. I had your job once. I was good at it.
I know.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions.
Who has the answers? It's Blade Runner 2049. What are we calling this? Is this a it's not a reboot or remake. It's just a sequel, right?
It's a sequel, but you wonder if it's going to be a sequel in the way that The Force Awakens was a sequel that kind of borrows the exact structure of the original film, or sort of tries in some ways to give you the same experience. I've avoided watching the trailer from the word go, and I even avoided listening to it right then because I don't have my headphones on. And I'm happy about that. I want to come to this film as cold as possible. I don't want to kind of have any idea what the plot is going to be. All we know is that Ryan Gosling is the detective on the replicant's trail this time, and Harrison Ford will pop up at some point and give kind of sage advice.
And are you kind of hiding your critical light under a bushel here? Is this because you're such a fan of the original movie?
I am a massive fan of Blade Runner, but it's partly that I just want the visuals to kind of surprise me. So, I mean, it's Denis Villeneuve, who's really building a very good career as a stylist. He's just coming off Arrival, which was a huge success, and he made Sicario before that. And I think he may really have the chops to kind of deliver a film as kind of visually intoxicating as Blade Runner was in the first place. He's got Roger Deakins, one of the best cinematographers in the world, shooting it for him. He's surrounded himself with all the right people. You just hope that it actually takes your breath away and that it's one of those films that really deserves to be seen in IMAX. I think the Oscars, when they come around, there's going to be a real battle probably between Dunkirk and this film for best cinematography. It's just they're clearly going to be the best looking films of the year, but let's wait to see what the images actually are, you know.
Okay, so Blade Runner 2014... is out on October the 6th here in the UK. Before that, Tim Raby chose The Death of Stalin. And before that, Call Me By Your Name, new from Luca Guadagnino. Thank you very much, Tim. We're going to turn to books now. John Richardson, you always come armed with an armful of paperbacks that we want to squirrel ourselves away with. We're going to start with These Darkening Days, new from Ben Myers. This sounds precisely up my street. Talk us through this.
Well, if you haven't discovered Ben Myers is doing something that other writers have done. He's a literary novelist. He's already published one literary novel this year, very, very good book called The Gallows Pole, which is a sort of historical novel. But he's also rather like the Dan Kavanagh, Julian Barnes alter ego, or the one that the Irish writer John Banville has, which whose name I can't remember, but he writes as a thriller. But Ben's doing it in under his own name, which is quite, I think, quite brave, but also quite brilliant. I mean, he inhabits this landscape. He lives in the North Calder Valley in Yorkshire, and he sets most of his books around there. This is the second thriller. I guess they'll end up being called Mace and Brindle thrillers, because the two characters he first introduced in 2015, a book called Burning Blue. This is, These Darkening Days, uses the same two characters, Mace, Roddy Mace, who's a heavy drinking reporter who's now trying to stop drinking, living on a narrowboat, and Brindle, James Brindle, who is a police detective who has been given not exactly compulsory leave because he went a bit mad and hasn't got a case. So he's spending his time in the gym. And then bad things start to happen in the town. A woman is found with her face slashed open. She survives. More slashings occur. And it's basically got a whodunit, brilliantly delivered. But what makes it different, I think, what makes these books so remarkable is the language. He's like James Ellroy with a flat cap and a terrier. I mean, it's
right.
They're really sleeve. Compelling, and they're northern, and it's still sinking into winter through the autumn. It's lots of drizzle. It's a small town, England. You know, it's kind of everybody's on benefits, everybody's drinking too much, everybody's taking terrible drugs. They're all the usual, as I say, the stock characters. But he breathes life into the stock characters, and it is a page turner, and the denouement and the solution to the mystery is as good as any I've read in a long, long time. It's a great book.
Is this very blatantly sort of genre fiction? Because there's something about the idea, when I think of Ben Myers, I think of something that you were talking about recently on the Backlisted podcast, a sort of folk horror.
Well, he is actually he's
there's a bit of that in it somehow.
It's folk crime is what you might call it. Okay. People have talked about it. He's definitely the idea of dark kind of undercurrents that this northern town, you know, that the patterns are repeating themselves. There's definitely that sense, the sort of the myths that sustain people. There are lots of very, very creepy characters in the book, and there's some very funny ones. There's some great set pieces. And I think it's quite rare for a writer to be able to do very good historical fiction and very good crime fiction. But the sensibility, the ability he's got, he writes brilliantly about the landscape. He writes brilliantly about weather. There's a great loads of stuff about rain in here. He claims that the people who live in this village are like Eskimos. They've got more words for rain because that's all it does. It just basically pisses down through the whole of the novel.
There's a lot of different genres we're going for. The new lots nature writing, it's the new folk horror.
Tick, tick,
and
tick,
it's James Ellroy in a flat cap. There's so much going on. It doesn't matter if this book costs £35 in paperback. It's worth it by the sound of it.
Right? It's a good book.
Ben Myers, his new book, not as a non-alter ego, but as the thriller-writing alter ego of the literary Ben Myers, is called These Darkening Days. John, your next choice is Sing, Unburied, Sing, new from Jessamyn Ward. Some people will be familiar with this name, but talk us through this one.
Jessamyn Ward won the National Book Award 2011 for her, I think it was her second novel, which was called Salvage the Bones, which was about a family surviving, a Katrina family in New Orleans. All her books have been set in Mississippi, Louisiana, which is where she's from. This comes with big endorsements from Margaret Atwood, from Marlon James, who won the Booker Prize 2 years ago. I've read two outstanding novels this year, leaving Ben Myers aside, which is also good. But the ones that really stuck in my head, one was The Underground Railroad, which we talked about, by Colson Whitehead, and the other was Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders, both on the Booker list this year. This is like some strange...
This seems like it kind of completes the set somehow.
It's sort of a strange combination of the two. It's essentially, it's a road movie. It's a dysfunctional family, a sort of mother who's on coke and everything else, meth. Her 13-year-old son, Jojo, and a three-year-old daughter. He's looking after the daughter. The mother is a sort of waitress and feckless. Wants to be a better mother, but can't get that balance right. Her parents are sort of where the kids live. And the book is them going to pick up her husband, Michael, who is white, who has been incarcerated in prison. And the idea is it's going to be, you know, happy family all reunited. It isn't happy family all reunited. It's a kind of it is classic journey into the dark heart of America. Both the mother Leonie and the son Jojo see ghosts. So there are dead people accompanying them on this journey. It's hard. I didn't think I'd read another novel as good as the two I mentioned earlier this year, but it is. I mean, she writes absolutely beautifully. It's heartrending. The relationship between the mother and the 13-year-old boy, he is coming into himself as a sort of a young adult, having to make sort of difficult choices, haunted by this other child who was died a horrible death. A lot of the sadness and darkness of the American South. But if you write this well, I mean, I think there will be comparisons. There have already been comparisons, I guess, to Faulkner and to The Beloved. That will always happen with a book with this kind of theme, I guess. But it does stand up to it. It's beautiful and compelling. I mean, not at all difficult to read. I think once you're kind of gripped by the story, you want to get, as it were, to the end of the road and find out what happens.
It's Sing, Unburied Sing. It's by Jessamine Ward. And that does sort of neatly bring us on to Ta-Nehisi Coates' We Were 8 Years in Power, an American Tragedy. This feels like a sort of winsomeness and a sadness at the turning of the season, a kind of presidential season or a political season in the United States.
Well, I mean, we're all kind of trying to make sense of what's going on. And the reason I chose this is that Ta-Nehisi Coates is, I mean, he's kind of, you know, he's sort of inherited, I guess, the sort of the mantle of James Baldwin. He's angry, but he's also brilliant. He's a great journalist. And this book is essentially 8 long essays, I think all of them or most of them coming from the Atlantic magazine where he's sort of stationed as a journalist. It just seemed to me if you wanted a primer to help you understand the strange transformation, how America can go from having its first black president to what Ta-Nehisi Coates calls its first white president. And he writes brilliantly about the sort of transition that almost that Trump's success came because of the sort of the fundamental sense of insult that too many Americans felt at having a black president. He writes about that, I think, better than anybody. He's being called sort of, you know, the black America's answer to Orwell. I mean, I don't know, but he writes with that kind of clarity. I mean, this is incredibly urgent, direct. The key essay in the book is a long essay about Obama and how Obama came to be so successful and how did he get to be elected? And it seems pretty astonishing. As he said, the sort of, you know, the idea that America had changed, it was always threatening to change back, and it's changed back in a pretty horrific way.
What is Coates' style? Is this urgent and hectoring, or is this a kind of slow, laconic look back over his shoulder last 8 years?
I mean, the comparison to Baldwin is good. If anybody's seen the great I'm Not Your Negro film, which was out early in the year, Baldwin's ability to go from this incredibly eloquent, almost like oratorial style to very personal, tender reminiscences. That's exactly what Coates is in exactly. He writes out of his own experience. He writes brilliantly about his own experiences of racism. But he lands his punches.
So there's that in similarity with the Baldwin as well. The personal going to the rhetorical.
Absolutely. He's not shrill. He just hits just, and again, brilliant journalism builds up that wonderful sense of detail. By the end, when he comes in with a sucker punch, he's sort of earned it.
It's Ta-Nehisi Coates, We Were 8 Years in Power, an American Tragedy. Also in the notes it says, Coates received the MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in 2015. Haven't we all, though, around this table, as recommended by John Mitchinson. Before that, we were talking about Sing, Unburied Sing by Jessamine Ward, and we started off with These Darkening Days by Ben Myers. Georgie Rogers, it's music time. We've got something new from Beck,
which
always excites me. Mm-hmm. Shall we have a slice of that, and then we can chat about it? Beck always cheers us up, although he didn't on his last album, but that was my favourite of his albums.
Yeah.
This one sounds a little bit more kind of sound like everything that came before. But
yes,
am I right?
This is Beck doing Funky Beck.
Okay.
Which we like. Definitely Funky Beck is good for Beck. But yeah, as you said, Morning Phase, that last album. This new one is his 13th. The last one won the Album of the Year Grammy Award, and it was a bit of wow, Beck's won it. And it was a beautiful, achingly beautiful record, capturing a kind of real sense of loneliness and reflecting on breakup scenes. It had more of a folk country lean with these kind of swoonful orchestral arrangements.
But
on it.
You couldn't remember kind of any of the songs off that record, but I played it to death.
Exactly.
It was a real piece of an album, I think.
Yeah, so this by nature is very different. Not only has he come back a lot quicker, the last album took, I think, about 6 years, and maybe it was quite sort of languid because he had some back problems and he did a bit of production, but I don't think he was able to actually play out live. So there was kind of that. Whereas this time it seems like he's a lot happier, maybe, and it's a lot poppier, it's a lot more upbeat, a lot more groovy. He worked on it with Greg Kurstin, and that relationship makes sense because he has produced Adele. He's also recently done the new Foo Fighters record, so he can do the kind of big pop thing, but then also the bombastic riffs a la Foo Fighters on this new track, The Sky's a Neighbourhood, which is kind of like a sci-fi epic. So, yeah. And Greg also was in his touring band back on Sea Change in 2002. But it seems like, yeah, it just seems like it's that track reminds me of Benfold's Five or Broken Bells. It's kind of jangly, super catchy choruses. The track Wow, which we first heard off this new album, actually came out about a year ago. So he's sort of been teasing us throughout the year. I think the album was meant to come out a lot earlier. But I've read interviews and it's sort of saying that they were trying to, it was quite a complex bunch of songs and it wasn't too retro or too modern. And they were trying to kind of make them all sit together nicely and make it a coherent whole album. But we got Wow about a year ago and that was kind of like, that did make me go, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was sort of the most hip hop he's ever gone, bringing in a bit of trap and urban influences with electronic, still with a kind of classic Beck footprint, memorable melody and sort of poppy chorus. So yeah, it's interesting to see where this album goes, but I think all the signs are suggesting that it's going to be a good one.
And what difference does working with a new producer make for someone like Beck, who's got such a reputation, can clearly write such good songs, has had his moments,
yeah,
you know, and he's had his wallowing moments, although I quite like those.
I like them.
But what difference does it, when you're such a star and you can clearly write such killer melodies, what difference is, or can you hear on this record, just working with a new producer?
Well, apparently they played all the instruments themselves, him and Greg. So it seems like it was definitely a real partnership. That's quite impressive, really, to play all the instruments.
Yeah, right, isn't it?
With just one other dude.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's interesting. I think probably it just changes up your approach or gives you a sort of different...
It's going to be weird on stage, isn't it? When they have their backs turned to all the other members of the band. Do we really need a bass player and a drummer?
Yeah, yeah.
Sod those guys.
Yeah, we did this ourselves.
Right.
I think he's kind of, as an artist, he's like the ultimate kind of cool hipster indie guy, isn't he, really? Like, and I think he's managed to...
And he's a Scientologist. Yes, he's a Scientologist.
Yeah. Right. He's managed to kind of...
Contents may have settled in transit with Beck slightly.
Yeah. But he has managed to kind of keep his credibility, hasn't he, really?
Oh, no, totally. He still knows how to wear a good hat.
He still knows how to wear a good hat and he still knows how to kind of play the part of that. I think it'll be interesting. There's one track that's up all night, which is the poppiest of all four, which is about wanting to stay up all night with someone, and it's kind of pushing the sound a bit towards a kind of Get Lucky,
yeah,
Daft Punk Pharrell thing. Very radio-friendly. I can imagine it'll probably get quite a lot of pickup on the radio. But maybe that's just about at the line of as far as you'd want it to go into that pop territory. But the other tracks on the album sound really great, so I think he's kind of keeping it on the right side of the line. I think he's sold out completely.
It is new from Beck. It's out on October the 13th on Capitol Records. It is simply called Colours. It's like a great album from the 90s where everything's just, all the songs have just got one name. Wow, Colours.
Yeah.
And things that haven't got one name. Yeah. Which, I'm wrong. Dreams. Okay, it works.
It works.
Three's a trend, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's fine.
God.
So next, and finally, Georgie, you've chosen Vessels, the Great Distraction. Let's have a bit of it. Good stuff. All kind of, what are we going there? All sort of 808, kind of classic samples and bits and bobs there.
Yeah.
Talk us through these guys.
They are a five-piece from Leeds, and this is their fourth album. And the last record saw them kind of eschew their more post-rock foundations for a much more electronic sound. The last album was kind of, it was absolutely huge. Like the John Hopkins Immunity way of thinking, really sort of a big progressive electronic sound, really melodic, hard-hitting techno beats, kind of a, in the way that Trent Moller builds yeah. these beautiful, just widescreen, epic electronic tunes. And I guess there's, you know, being five of them in the band, there's loads of the electronics, but then there's also the live thing going on with guitars and drums and bass and synths. For this record, I think it just shows that they're kind of building on the last record and making things even maybe a bit bigger, but also the collaborations, it sort of shows that their pool of people that they can use for some of the vocal tracks is bigger, because they've got some really interesting collaborations on this. They've got that track that you just heard was Wayne Coyne and the Flaming Lips.
Really, was that Wayne Coyne? I didn't hear that.
Yeah, so that was, and I think they've spoken about how that's one of their favourite things on the album, because it's so Vessels, but it's also very Flaming Lips, the two kind of meeting of both artists. They've also got John Grant on this
always
new record.
Good.
Who is always amazing. I haven't heard that track yet, but I think it finishes the album. I can't wait to hear that. And then Vincent Neff, who's the singer and guitarist from Django Django, is on it. And then Casey Harkin of Skylarkin and Slater Kinney. It just kind of, yeah, very much follows on from what they've done before. It's like there's some instrumental tracks on there that are just super intense, pretty ravey. Bangers.
we're going into the autumn, but we're smiling.
Yeah.
We were up all night, we can't help it.
Yeah.
What does it say to you when people like Wayne Coyne, then people from Sleater Kinney, legendary bands, yeah. kind of are teaming up with a band that, you know, people in the know have heard of? Is that a kind of coming of age thing, do you think? Is that?
Yeah, maybe. They're definitely a band that I think probably will get more notoriety with this album.
And where do we go? Where do we go to dance to this when it's the autumn? Festivals have just finished. Did this record come out at the wrong time of year?
No, I don't think it has, because they're doing a show at Village Underground in London, and I'm imagining like this record needs a serious visual show with it.
Okay.
And them and lights, you know. And so I can imagine, you know, it's just such a huge sound. It is. It could sort of soundtrack a film about the end of the world.
Wow.
There are some themes on there about sort of like one of the tracks is called Radio Decay. It's about the last signals of a dead civilization drifting out into infinity.
We in this show have had some really good poster quotes, right?
We've
had this song could soundtrack the actual end of the world, not a film about it.
The actual end of the world.
John said this is like James. This man is Ben Myers is like James Elroy wearing a flat cap and with a whippet. And Tim Robey refuses to see the new Blade Runner film because he's looking forward
trailer,
to it so
trailer.
Much. Trailer, okay. Not the film, the trailer.
Not the whole film, sorry.
I don't know whether that's going to make it over the Odeon Leicester Square. I refuse to see this. I'm too excited. Tim Robey, the Daily Telegraph. By the way, we were talking there finally about Vessels, the great distraction. Great. It sounds like it's Kim Jong-un's personal soundtrack and possibly Donald Trump's. Great stuff, right?
Down in the club.
Georgie Rogers, thank you very much indeed. My thanks also, of course, to Tim Robey and John Mitchinson for your wonderful descriptions of your wonderful choices. You have been listening to Culture. My producer was, of course, Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. Join us again at the same time next week. For the time being, thanks for tuning in.